Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we travel back to 1978.
Okay, cool. I'm ready. I just dug my bell bottoms out of storage.
Okay, Patrick, I mentioned yesterday that it's taken us a while, but we finally coaxed Bill Mulligan into coming on the show. Listener Bill Mulligan, a supporter of Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
Not only did we get him for like one appearance, we're getting him for two. He's doing an encore today.
That's right.
As a patron of the podcast, Bill gets to come on and pick the topic. And yesterday we talked about Lee Hazlewood, and it was really fun. And I also want to mention people can go to patreon.com/suburbspod and learn how to become a patron of the show. Although I think all the guest spots are pretty much
taken up. Yeah.
Unless you go into the record collector level, you also get the guest spots for that. And you get records too. So
just go check it out. There may be one or two slots of that left.
And before we get started here with today's topic, I'm just going to mention that I'm about to open this another beer courtesy of Trip Bacon out there in Oregon by the Good Life Brewing Company. I think it's Sweet As. Is that... it's kind of hard
to
read.
That is correct.
Sweet As Pacific Ale. I'm going to open that. But here's the thing I want to show you on the can. I'm holding up to the Zoom camera here for you guys. Mm-hmm. It says very explicitly here, keep cold.
Keep cold.
Keep cold.
Words to live by.
Do we not know this? I've been drinking beer since I was 15. I think I know that by now. But anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Sweet
Well, I'll tell you, my good friend Andy is well into sobriety, and I'm so proud of him and everybody that is strong enough to make that change in their lives. And Andy used to have a funny term that I still use today, which was 7-Eleven cold. So, how cold is it? Is this cold? Well, 7-Eleven cold.
Right.
And it still applies today.
Cold as.
It's just sort of cold, but it's trying to be cold, it's really not. You have to convince yourself it's cold.
But there's some guy with a spreadsheet at the 7-Eleven corporate headquarters going, if we turn up the temperature in all of our locations across the board, look how much money we'll save, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. 48 degrees is fine.
That's right. Okay, so where are we here? Oh, welcome, Bill Mulligan.
Thank you.
That's where I was going with all of that.
As I want to do.
Okay, so yesterday I mentioned was Lee Hazlewood. If you haven't heard that, go back and listen to that. That was super fun and very entertaining and educational. Now today, what are we going to talk about, Bill?
Well, today promises to be less educational, but hopefully no less entertaining. As you often see these things floating around on the internet about songs that were popular when you were this age, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I think a survey or a study came out recently that scientifically proved that whatever was at the top of the charts when you were 14 is most likely to have influenced your musical tastes. So that got me curious, and I started looking into what was popular when I was 14. And fortunately, most of what was popular did not influence my musical taste since it was 1978. Ooh. But I did find a number of albums, though, that I discovered roughly in that time period that have remained important to me. Some were popular, some were not. And I figured since I pay the money, I wanted to talk about this topic. So,
And that's an interesting thing, too, Bill, because we've also recently had, Jim, right, some debut albums of other years that patrons have chosen.
That's right.
And so it plays along that theme.
That's right.
And I just want to say this. I love the direction it's going because Bill's taking it backwards. And I think if we take it backwards enough, we'll get back to my favorite debut album year in music, 1949.
Oh, is that right?
We'll get there. I am ready, man.
That's when you were 14?
I was 11.
Okay. All right. Yep. Okay. So what are we doing? 1978. Okay.
I wanted to look at these albums that were important to me. Mm-hmm. As a little bit of background, I'm the oldest child. I think I mentioned previously, I don't know if it made air, that my parents had a lot of music on when I was young.
Yep.
But it was strictly what was coming through the radio, top 40. I don't have any older siblings who handed me records, so this was the point where, even though I had been listening to music before, these are the albums that stuck with me. Mm-hmm. You know, Orleans, Leo Sayer, I had heard those prior to 1978, but they didn't really become an important part of my life. Mm-hmm. These albums have, for various reasons. And I decided when I was trying to limit my topic, just so that I could get my arms around it, to go with debut albums from that year.
Yep.
Beautiful. Maybe every year has a lot of really great debut albums, but I was struck by the number of debut albums in 78. So the first album that I would like to mention, and I think it's been discussed recently on the podcast, is Van Halen by Van Halen.
Yes.
This is the one that I probably least able to verbalize why it's important to me, or maybe what's proper to say is that this one was the one that was more viscerally mm-hmm. important to me.
Yeah.
I had never been a big fan of hard rock. And I know some people might argue with characterizing Van Halen as hard rock. It's not going to necessarily knock the cross off your bedroom wall. but it certainly got an aggression to it, a certain testosterone flowing through it that has an impact on a 14-year-old mm-hmm. or a 13-year-old at that point. You know, it gets the id of a teenage boy really riled up. Yeah. You know, it opens with that, I don't know what it is, it's probably a guitar tone, but it almost sounds like a siren or a car horn. And then right into those bass notes that almost sound like your heart beating in your chest. It just, you know, it's impossible to ignore, especially when you're a 14-year-old boy. And, you know, and so you're having all these reactions to it, and David Lee Roth hasn't even started talking about his good friend the devil yet. I mean, so it was just a real gut punch, if you will, and not in a negative sense, but it really had an impact. This was not music I was thinking about. This was music I was reacting to.
And how much of that, Bill, do you think had to do with the guitar sound? Because,
oh yeah,
I mean, right now I would cut off a few of my toes to be able to get like that guitar sound on your guitar when you play.
Oh, definitely. You know? And in fact, you know, you get hit with Running with the Devil, and yeah. then you don't even have time to breathe, and you're into eruption. You know, Eruption, which still to this day, I'm like George McFly rolling around on the ground with the headphones on his ears.
It doesn't make any sense. You know, right.
Yeah. So it's just an amazing 1-2 punch. And then you get hit with the third punch you really got me. Mm-hmm. And with all due respect to the Davies brothers, this version versus the Kinks is kind of like a 200 watt stereo versus a transistor radio that you got in your hand.
Right about that. Yep.
So, you know, by the time Ain't Talking About Love is over, you know, any 14-year-old boy is swagging around the room, feeling actually like he could talk to some young lady that he might encounter. So it's just, like I said, for me, it opened my ears to harder music. I didn't become a heavy metal fan, but it definitely influenced me. It made me appreciate music that you react to in a real animalistic way, in a real visceral way. My second album is The Cars by The Cars. So this was released in June. Eventually reached 18 on the charts, number 18, sold 6 million copies. And this is probably the one that made the biggest impression on me at that time. I'm not unique in this observation, but there was something about The Cars' cool detachment, especially vocally, that at the time I associated it with a nerdiness. It was very different than Van Halen, obviously.
Right.
And as a nerd, I found this nerdiness to be attractive. Vocally, the delivery had this wonderfully cool, I don't want to say alien sound to it, but it was, it didn't seem like everything else that you were listening to at the time. And it was talking about hanging out with a girl, which is something I really wanted to do at that time. So
we all did.
Yeah.
Dancing down the street with the suede blue eyes. Every new boy that you meet, it doesn't know the real surprise. Here she comes again when she's dancing beneath the starry sky. She'll make you free. Here she comes again when she's dancing beneath the starry sky.
One of those strange little memories that sticks out in your head. I remember one Friday after a football game, a bunch of us were driving around in the back roads of Fort Belvoir. And this is back when you could still drive around on Fort Belvoir without attracting the MPs. And my best friend's girl came on the radio. And I told everybody in the car to be quiet because I loved the song so much that I wanted to hear it. And the guy who was riding shotgun was the biggest guy in the car. And he turned and he glared at me and said, "Don't you like my singing?" And then he got a big grin on his face and punched me in the shoulder. But
I'll say this about The Cars too. The simplicity of the production of that record to me is genius.
That's right.
How they took those elements, pared them down to just the best parts of them and put them together in like the best way, and use of hand claps and harmonies and background vocals and some of those things that you associate with, like, oh gosh, man, it's like a doo-wop record or like a Sun Records technique, right? To have a hand clap.
That's right.
You know, all this stuff, that is genius to me. And Okasic later proved to be, you know, obviously he produced a Suicide record, so he understood, you know, the whole New York scene and all that too. And even though they were from Boston, there was a lot of punk in Boston at that time. Mission of Burma was playing,
right.
and Okasic, you know, used to see those guys. So it's amazing how it blends all those different kinds of things. And I think they introduced many, many people to the concept of new wave, Bill, and that's well said.
It's almost like a deconstruction of pop music when you listen to The Cars, you know?
Up to that time, yeah.
That's right.
Time.
Next is Dire Straits by Dire Straits.
Mm.
And this is the last eponymous album on my list. So
okay.
I was surprised in my research that it reached number two on the charts.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
I don't know why I didn't think it was as popular at the time.
Right.
I view that, this, it, you can just pick one of those pronouns, as the anti-Van Halen, in the sense that it isn't loud or fast. It doesn't arouse any animal passions. You know, it's not, Mark Knopfler isn't screaming, "Hey, baby, come and get it," a la David Lee Roth. So they're more the songs. And yes, I was this sensitive and introspective as a 14-year-old. The songs are more like memories, stories.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, like Down to the Waterline, like it's almost like a series of memories. Partial memories that somebody has, mm-hmm. you know. Others, obviously, like Sultan's a Swing. That's a whole little, that's a whole little story there.
Right.
In some ways, the whole thing comes together like a collection of little short foreign films or something.
Mm.
I guess Dire Straits was making movies at this point.
So, there you go. Well said.
Surrender on the quayside. You remember we used to run and hide in the shadow of the cargoes. I take you one time. We're counting all the numbers down to the waterline. When neon misses on the dog leaf stairway. Friends' kisses in the darkened doorway. Foghorn blowing out a wild and cold. The policeman he shines a light on my shoulder.
I also find it to be something. This is going to sound pejorative, but it's not. It's a great album to fall asleep to.
Interesting.
It's kind of transporting.
Yeah, it is.
It's very.
I can see that. Yeah.
And especially when you're lying down in bed. I certainly wouldn't try to fall asleep to Van Halen.
No. No.
And then, you know, and so it transports you, whether it's just for the, let's say, 3 minutes, but on this album, most of them are probably 5 or 6 minutes long.
Yep.
Whether it's just for those few minutes or whether it's for 8 hours, it transports you away. So, but which isn't to say that it's boring or dull or anything. So, I don't know exactly in what ways it influenced me.
Yep.
My musical tastes, but I do know that Dire Straits is still one of my favorite bands. Now, those last three, I definitely remember listening to in 1978. I will admit that these next two, time has kind of compressed my memories, and I'm not completely certain if I was on board with these two at the very beginning, but it didn't take very long before I got there.
Okay.
So the next one is Outlandos Do Amor by The Police.
The Police.
And along with Dire Straits, The Police are one of those groups where at some point in my life I would have said, that's my favorite band today. But what's interesting about this album, I think, is that it's not a punk album, but it kind of introduced me to punk. And it's not a reggae album, but it kind of introduced me to reggae. Also, but even though it's probably closest to being a punk album, which, you know, is kind of how they started. But it didn't have any of the political overtones, or not overtones, explicitness that that you associate with a lot of punk. In fact, the only song on the whole album that might be political, I think, is Born in the 50s, mm-hmm. which is more of a meditation on why people who born in the 50s were disengaged from society because they thought they were going to be blown up at any minute by, yep. by the Russians.
Yep. I'll tell you this, Bill, and Jim, since we've been talking about, you know, back in the early days in high school and junior high and all that, I got to tell you, there was a girl in high school who I really liked and hung out with sometimes. And I got to say, one night I had the opportunity to show her that I had the first Police album, and it was very impressive. I won't say just how impressive it was for me personally, but it was impressive that I had was able to pull out this record and put it on. And guess what? I played side two. I remember that very clearly. I was like, dude, you got to take a chance here and go with side two.
Her name wasn't Sally, was it?
No. Unfortunately, that would have been great. Probably, to me, the best song on the record is Can't Stand Losing You. And yep. that opens side two. I mean, I know Roxanne was the big hit and all that, but... you know, when you look at that original copy, that's what you drop the second side on.
I want to say one quick thing about Outlandish D'Amour, which is for anyone who wasn't around at this time or hasn't discovered this record or what have you, who knows the sting of the last 30 years or whatever it may be, right?
Yes, yes, Jim.
Not only go back and listen to this, but also just look at the album cover art, and it feels like so different than what you know, like the sort of... hippy dippy sort of tantric sex sting to be right. It's like those block sans serif letters, the Police, and then like the sort of typewriter letters underneath, and they look like, to your point, Bill, they kind of look like punks, right? They just you know,
and that's how it sounds, man. It's that's fast right. and it's tight it and is. It's got reggae influences.
It's so tight. They were definitely a tight band, weren't they?
And you know, like you said it well, Jim, but that guy, I mean, he was in Quadrophenia too.
Yeah, so, that's right.
You know, you got to remember that kind of person.
Not the guy playing the lute.
No. You know? Right.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned my last thing I wanted to mention about the album was...
All right, so what do we have next?
All right. Save the best for last, as it were. You can pick your title. It's either Pure Pop for Now People or Jesus of Cool. As I'm sure all listeners to the podcast are aware, I'm Nick Lowe is my favorite singer. I indicated there were two titles.
Explain that.
Well, Nick Lowe, I don't know if this is part of it, but Nick Lowe is a smartass. Which is one of the things I love about him. And, you know, as my father used to always say, it's better to be a smartass than a dumbass. Right. So, and he wanted to name his album, Jesus of Cool.
Right.
And in that place over there in England, I guess A&M, was fine with that. And then when they brought it to Columbia, Columbia said, I'm sorry, this is the United States. Right. You cannot release an album entitled Jesus the Cool in the United States.
Nope.
Especially in 1978.
Right.
Nope.
So they changed the title. Now, if you actually look, again, I won't get it. It's behind me. If you look at the cover of Jesus of Cool, it's the six pictures of him, right?
Yep.
Yep.
If you look in the corner of this, each of the six pictures, it already says in there, pure, spelled out, pure pop for now people. So they just took, it's almost like it wasn't officially used as the subtitle of the album, but it was kind of the subtitle for the album anyway. And they used that. They also, when they released it in the United States, and I know this isn't the only album this ever happened to, they changed the track order around. And, yep. And I think they dropped one or two songs and added some. So when I first encountered the album, it was as pure pop for now people.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, the first song is So It Goes. It's the only song that I feel confident about being able to recite all the lyrics to from memory.
I remember the night the kid cut off his right arm, hit a bit to save a bit of power. He got 50,000 watts in a big acoustic tower. Security's so tight tonight, oh, they're ready for a tussle. Gotta keep your backstage passes, 'cause the promoter had the muscle. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. The way it's going, no one knows. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes. The way it's going, no one knows.
You know, most of this album, like a lot of Lowe's early works, it's not, musically, it's not very complex. In fact, it's very,
right.
Very simple. Mm-hmm. Although it is fast, as I found out 6 or 10 years ago when I was trying to learn guitar, and I've always asked my teacher if we could play some Nick Lowe song, and I'd end up maybe being able to do it at half the speed that it was on the record if I was lucky.
Right.
So I just love this album because of his attitude. Like I said, he's just, he comes across, he's sarcastic, he's funny. The lyrics are all pretty simple, but they're simple, but they're really smart.
Yep.
Like for most people, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the song Mary Provost.
Oh, yes. For sure.
That's a great song.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife was really pissed the time I played that for my kids when they were like 10 and 7. So apparently that story, he took it from what was in Hollywood Babylon, the book.
Yep.
What was in the book was largely fictitious.
Right.
So I was going to say unfortunately, it's not a true story, although it's kind of perverse that I'm disappointed that some woman wasn't eaten by her dachshund after she passed away.
Right. Well, as Jim and I have both heard probably in our lifetimes, between the truth and the legend, Jim, what do you print?
Yeah, you print the legend.
There you go.
Mary Provost did not look her best. The day the cops bust into a lonely nest in the cheap hotel up on Hollywood West. She'd been lying there for 2 or 3 weeks. The neighbors said they never heard a squeak. But hungry eyes that could not speak said even little doggies have got to eat. She was a winner. That became the doggies dinner. She never meant that much to me.
Another song that I love on this album that kind of shows the Nick's attitude is Roller Show.
Mm, yes.
Which
Hell
is
yes.
played completely straight
yep.
as a Bay City Rollers fan, all excited about going to see the show that night.
I love the Bay City Rollers.
It's just completely, it's done completely straight.
Yeah.
I don't know what problem Nick Lowe had with the Bay City Rollers, other perhaps than having listened to their album. Because after he left for Brinsley Schwartz broke up, but before he started recording his own material, he was still under contract to United Artists through the Brinsley Schwartz contract. And he wanted to get out of that contract. So he thought, I'll just start writing songs that are so bad that they will release me from my contract.
They'll have to fire me. Yeah.
Yeah. So he wrote a song. Let me get the title right. He wrote a song entitled Bay City Rollers, We Love You. It was released under the name of The Tartan Horde. And it was being represented as the official Bay City Rollers fan club theme song.
Sweet.
Unfortunately for Nick, apparently this became a hit, at least in Japan.
Right. And I was going to say, and how didn't this guy break in America? All his references were so British and like so clever and so dry and so Monty Python. It was so brilliant. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound anti-American, but I think he was just too smart for us.
That's right.
But you know, it's interesting too. We were talking about the Police, and you know, on this record, you also get that melding of, you know, the influence of punk. You get reggae, right, man? Because Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, like that's a song, you know, that I would listen to that a million times in a row. And it captures a little deeper that the soul of the Jamaican influence in England and the reggae and all that stuff, and the dry British wit too, you know, is there. So it, oh man, it's obvious, you know, I never would have gotten this record in 78. I mean, there's no way. I don't think I understood Nick Lowe until like the 90s or something after I'd listened to all these records. But yeah, it's so, so brilliant. Well, Bill, thank you, man, so much for this. This has been so much fun. And,
yeah, it was fun.
I want to say a couple things, too. Number one, folks, go and look up some of the 78 debut albums. I think Bill has done an amazing job in picking the albums he did. But there's also some really, really interesting stuff that I think will put stuff in context. But I do want to say one thing about an album that came out in 78, which I think gets at the heart of everything we're talking about. Like, there was so many things, especially in the UK, between punk and reggae and you know, new wave that Bill was talking about. Like, to me, it was like, finally, your mind can sort of understand that all these things can live together and it can be really cool. You know, you don't have to take one side or the other. But the first Public Image album came out, first issue in 78.
It's on my list.
And totally. And man, you know, just think about how far it had gone in what, I don't know, 14, 15 months from being the Sex Pistols and,
crazy,
like, you know, vomiting on the steps of EMI's contract or whatever. And then suddenly he puts out Public Image, you know, with all those influences and the title track, you know, totally explaining how he felt manipulated by Malcolm McLaren and how smart Johnny, you know, John Lydon was. And that just goes to show you. Also, Prince put his first album out in 78. So
wow.
It's amazing to think
XTC.
About. Yes, XTC.
What else did I have on here? You mentioned Public Image Limited. Yeah. Nicolette Larson, if you're into that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was a big hit album, too.
Generation X.
Yep, that's right. Hmm. Yeah, a different side of the punk.
Yeah.
Right? They took it a different way, and it's amazing to just look at this year. What a great topic. Also, Devo, right? Are We Not Men? No.
Yes,
we are
yes.
Devo, yep. Yeah. So, amazing. Totally amazing. And just really enjoyed this. So, thank you, Bill.
All right. Let's get out of here. It's but this has been great. This has been really great, Bill. Thank you very much. If any listeners have any comments on debut albums of 1978 that we haven't mentioned, maybe, or the ones we have mentioned, if you want to talk more about those, call, leave a message. We'll put your voice on an upcoming episode. The number is 612-440-1984. There you go. Or email rock@suburbspod.com or post a comment on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @SuburbsPod. All right. Thanks very much, Bill. I know we owe you some more patron episodes, so we'll be in touch and we'll have you on again soon. You have been fantastic.
Thank you. It's been amazing. Thanks, Bill.
Hopefully next time we'll be in person. We'll all get together, right?
Yes.
Yes,
I look forward to that day.
Okay.
Me too.
All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Bill Mulligan.
And we'll talk to you all later.
Thanks, Bill. Kiss solo albums came out in 1978. Do you guys consider those debut albums?
That would require that I consider them at all, so.
Good answer.
The lawyer has disallowed the question. That's strike right. That from the record.
That's right.